We've drawn the name of one of the alternates at random, and that lucky alternate is, drumroll please, Teresa Lucas. Call your next witness, please.
Jay Flatley.
Jay Flatley, called as a witness by the plaintiff, having been first duly sworn, was examined and testified as follows.
Would you please state your full name and spell your last name for the record?
Jay Flatley, F-L-A-T-L-E-Y.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Flatley.
Good morning.
Are you presently employed by Illumina?
I am.
What is your present position, sir?
I'm president, CEO, and director, 1385.
So are you the senior-most officer at Illumina?
Yes.
Have you been president, CEO, and a member of the board of directors your entire employment with Illumina?
Yes.
When did your employment with Illumina begin?
On October 18th, 1999.
Take a look, please, at Exhibit 361. Mr. Flatley, do you recognize this exhibit as a copy of your resume?
I do.
And this was your resume through and including your employment with Molecular Dynamics?
That's correct.
Is this the resume you submitted to Illumina during the time that you were negotiating with Illumina for employment?
I don't recall whether I actually submitted a resume to Illumina or not.
Molecular Dynamics was your employment immediately before Illumina, is that right?
That's correct, although I was technically an employee of Amersham Pharmacia Biotech.
Which is an affiliate of...
No, Molecular Dynamics was an affiliate of Amersham.
Now, were you a founder of Molecular Dynamics?
I was.
And you included the fact that you were founder on your resume, correct?
That's correct.
Do you agree, sir, that there's some prestige associated with being a founder of a company?
Marginal.
Marginal enough for you to include it on your resume?
Yes. Most people who are founders, if they technically were, will include it on a resume.
Would you agree that there is some additional importance to being recognized as a founder in a situation where the company that you founded has been successful and gone public?
I frankly don't think so. I think the real prestige from a company being successful comes from your participation in that company and how you contribute to making a company successful. A founder title is largely ceremonial.
Again, it was important enough for you to include it as an item of significance on your resume.
Sure.
Objection asked and answered.
Cumulative sustained.
Mr. Flatley, when you took over at Illumina, what was Tony Zarnik's position?
He was the chief scientific officer.
At that point, was Tony Zarnik a member of Illumina's senior management team?
Yes, he was.
Now, sir, do you claim that you came on board at Illumina with a completely clean slate as it relates to Tony Zarnik?
If by clean slate you mean I had preconceptions regarding Tony Zarnik, that's right. I did not know Tony Zarnik, had never heard of Tony Zarnik before I started at Illumina.
At about the time you joined the company, sir, were you given any type of a briefing?
Could you speak more into the microphone?
Sure.
At the time you joined Illumina, were you given any type of a briefing with respect to the background and the experience of a senior staff that you were going to be taking over?
Yes, I was.
Did John Stupnagel provide you with any background concerning the skills, experience, or abilities of any of the senior staff members?
No.
Did John Stupnagel... Strike that. John Stupnagel was a previous acting CEO who you had taken over from.
He was acting CEO, yes.
You essentially replaced him in that position as a permanent CEO.
Yes.
And the former acting CEO, John Stupnagel, did he give you any background on the job performance of any of the managers that you were inheriting from him?
No.
Never had a discussion about that?
No.
Didn't Dr. Stupnagel tell you anything about the skills and abilities of the people you were inheriting on his senior management team?
He did not.
Did you review the personnel files of any members of your senior management team in anticipation of taking over their supervision?
I did not.
Did you have any preconceived notions or ideas regarding Tony Zarnik at the time you joined Illumina?
Objection asked and answered.
Overruled.
I had never heard of Tony Zarnik before I started Illumina.
My question was whether you had any preconceived notions about it.
If I never heard of him, it would be impossible to have any preconceived notions about him. I didn't even know his name.
Ms. Kearns asked about the circumstances when a new CEO comes on board and wants to bring on his or her own team. You heard that testimony, the questioning, when you were here in the courtroom?
Can you refresh my memory on that again?
Sure. Ms. Kearns asked Dr. Zarnik about circumstances where a new CEO comes on board, and some new CEOs want to bring on their own team. That wasn't the case with you, was it?
That was not the case.
You didn't have any plans when you joined Illumina that you would want to bring on your own team?
Well, I should say that the management team when I arrived at Illumina consisted of four executives. It was very clear with the intention we had of growing the company to be large and successful that I was going to need to make substantial additions to the senior management team, and that was a charter I had from the board of directors. So it was very clear that one of my obligations was to bring on additional senior managers into the company, and I planned to do that.
But in terms of replacing people because you wanted your own team, you had no plans to do that, did you?
No.
Well, at the time you joined Illumina, sir, what were your plans, if any, with respect to making changes in personnel?
At the time I joined Illumina, I didn't know any of the players at Illumina, so I had no plans whatsoever. I knew nothing about the people.
At the time you joined the company, did you have any plans whatsoever with respect to reorganizing or restructuring the management team?
No.
Did you have any plans at all with respect to Tony Zarnik?
No.
Did you have any plans at all with respect to the position of chief scientific officer?
No.
Was it your philosophy, sir, when you first came on board at Illumina, that you would make your own independent evaluation of the members of your senior management team?
That's correct.
And the evaluation of your senior management team would be based on your own personal observations, true?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say my evaluation had to be exclusively only my observations. If the day after I got there, somebody came to me and said, "We have a criminal in a particular position," I would have listened to them. So, no, I won't say I came in with blinders on saying I wouldn't listen to any input. But the day I walked in, I had no input.
Primarily, you were going to rely on your own evaluation, what you saw and heard, as opposed to what other people were telling you about your team. Is that fair to say?
I was going to evaluate people, what methodology I would use to do that. I showed up, I had a team, I didn't know anybody on the team, and I went to work. So I didn't think through what my preconceived notions were with regard to how to evaluate people.
So when you began your employment on October 18th of 1999, you didn't know anything at that point about any alleged performance problems on the part of Dr. Zarnik. Is that true?
That's true.
Is it correct, sir, that you had only one 45-minute discussion with Tony Zarnik in the first few weeks after you came on board at Illumina?
No.
That's not true?
That's not true.
How many meetings, sir, did you have with Tony Zarnik, say in the first 2 to 3 weeks of your employment?
I had many meetings with Tony Zarnik, and Tony Zarnik, frankly, was the only person on my team I was having individual scheduled one-on-ones with because he requested those. The other senior managers, I was not having those. We were a very small company, about 25 people at the time I joined, and most of our interactions were at our weekly staff meetings I instituted right after I got there, and hallway conversations and after-hours, stand-up-by-the-file-cabinets sort of discussion. So the only meetings I was having on a one-on-one basis with were Tony Zarnik.
And the lunch you had with Dr. Zarnik in late October of 1999?
Yes.
How many one-on-one meetings had you had with Dr. Zarnik prior to that lunch?
At least one or two.
One or two?
Uh-huh.
One of them would be
exclusive of staff meetings where the group gets together.
Right. I'm talking about individual one-on-one discussions.
That's right.
Is one of those occasions the 45-minute meeting you had? Ms. Kern showed some emails reflecting that you had a series of 45-minute meetings scheduled.
For clarity, we should point out that that 45-minute schedule predated my arrival at Illumina. I didn't begin working at Illumina until the 18th of October. That series of meetings was a program I sent you to try to get myself up to speed in advance of my arrival, and those meetings occurred on September 24th. So that meeting would have been in addition to one-on-ones I had with Tony after I arrived on the 18th.
I see. Okay. So those meetings were sometime in September, when you were sort of getting acquainted with the company, but hadn't yet officially begun work?
I had only been to Illumina about 3 times for half a day to maybe a day each before my official start on the 18th of October. These meetings were the 24th of September when I was... After I accepted my offer, I came down and we scheduled a meeting with the entire company to introduce me, the new CEO, to the company. And on that same day, I scheduled 45-minute meetings with all the senior managers.
Let's talk about that lunch with Dr. Zarnik in October of 1999. Do you recall the date of that?
I believe it was about 10 days after I started, so it was probably near the end of the month. End of the month of October.
And Dr. Zarnik had requested that lunch, is that right?
The very first day I arrived on the job, I got an email from Dr. Zarnik requesting a lunch meeting with me.
That meeting was held approximately 10 days after?
That's right.
Do you recall the discussion at the end of that lunch, or any time that day, frankly, where Dr. Zarnik told you that he could be cynical at times?
Yes.
Is that what he said? Something to the effect, you know, I can be cynical at times?
Yes.
And you responded, are you sure it isn't more than that?
No, that was not my response.
What was your response?
I engaged Tony in a discussion about what the word cynical meant and why he considered himself to be a cynic. In my mind, the word cynical has a negative connotation. Someone is a naysayer, or someone dismisses information out of hand without thinking it through. And I enjoined him in discussion about the difference between what I considered a cynic and what I considered a skeptic, where a skeptic is someone who might look at information and be thoughtful about it, but wasn't inherently negative. Our conversation revolved around that distinction, and in fact, it turned out that Tony was right. He was a cynic, and is a cynic.
You don't recall any point in that conversation, Dr. Zarnik saying something to the effect, look, I'm not comfortable talking about this again now?
Could you repeat the question?
Do you recall at any point during that discussion that Dr. Zarnik said something to the effect, I'm not comfortable talking about this subject matter right now?
No.
Did you and Dr. Zarnik on this same occasion talk about whether it would be necessary for you to hold regular meetings between yourself and Dr. Zarnik?
Tony and I had, as I mentioned, a couple of one-on-one meetings during my initial startup phase in the first 4 weeks. We had had a number of these, and during one or more of these, we discussed the idea whether we should have one-on-one meetings, and Tony seemed to like that idea. We discussed it. And we decided not to hold regular one-on-one meetings because, I guess for the most part, we were having staff meetings on a regular basis. So we mutually agreed not to have one-on-one meetings.
Do you recall at about this time of the October lunch, October 1999, that you talked about whether weekly or, whether regular meetings would be required? And Dr. Zarnik said something to the effect, I don't need to have regular meetings, but I do need to be sure that if I don't hear from you, I can assume I'm doing a good job.
Well, we never used the phrase, would one-on-one meetings be required, because they are never really required. So we didn't have that conversation in those words. But we did discuss whether it was appropriate to have one-on-one meetings. And my management style is to try to work with the people that work for me in styles that are most comfortable for them. So we had a discussion about whether my working relationship with Tony should include weekly one-on-one meetings or even more frequently. At the end of that discussion, we concluded that we did not need one-on-one meetings, and we left it at that.
Didn't Dr. Zarnik tell you essentially that unless he heard back from you regarding something negative, he would assume that he was performing adequately?
Dr. Zarnik in those early meetings was already soliciting feedback from me about his performance. I told him, Tony, I don't know you. I don't know anything about your performance. And we had that discussion a couple of times. And he did come to me as a result of that type of conversation. He said to me, well, if I don't hear from you, I will assume I'm doing an excellent job. Is that right? I said yes.
So you agreed that unless he heard from you, he could assume he was doing an excellent job?
That's correct.
When did he first hear from you that he was doing something less than an excellent job?
I would say the first time was probably late November into December. There were a couple of sessions where we had discussions about performance in November or December.
Late November or December of 1999?
Yes.
We'll get back to that. When did you first consider replacing Tony Zarnik as chief science officer?
I'd say it's a very difficult question to answer because my impressions of Tony, grew over time. and my very first impressions of him were in the group interview session we had. If you're asking me whether I concluded I wanted to make the change, I can give you that information. But the word consider is tough for me to answer because it was just a process that went on over the course of 4 or 5 months.
Let me refer to your deposition testimony on this point.
Sure.
It's at the beginning at page 117, line 22. Your testimony is...
117, line 22?
Oh, my mistake, 116. Sorry. Beginning at page 116, line 22. When did you first consider replacing Tony Zarnik as CSO?
I don't recall a date.
Approximately when?
I would approximate the end of January.
January 2000?
Yes.
Is that a fair approximation, sir, the end of January 2000, when you first considered replacing Dr. Zarnik?
Again, I would say that was the time frame when I was beginning to reach a conclusion about replacing Dr. Zarnik.
My question to you had been, when did you first consider it?
And my response was that consideration. I mean, if you were to plot a graph of my impressions of Tony, they were increasingly negative over the period from when I started with the company. So to pick a date when I would say I was first considering it is difficult. The point that I first began to, in my mind, reach conclusions that I was going to replace him were roughly in the time frame you cited.
Are you contradicting your sworn testimony that you first considered replacing Tony Zarnik as CSO in late January of 2000?
Not at all. I'm drawing a finer distinction than perhaps I did during the deposition.
Now, do you recall having lunch with Larry Bach, where you discussed Tony Zarnik?
I recall having lunch with Larry Bach.
Where you discussed Tony Zarnik?
My recollection on discussing Tony Zarnik is very vague in that meeting. I think it's a possibility. I don't have any specific recollection.
You were here when we played the videotaped deposition testimony of Larry Bach.
I was.
And you recall he testified to a lunch meeting that occurred where you talked to him about Tony Zarnik?
He testified to the fact that there was a lunch meeting and that there had been some conversation about Tony in the meeting.
You don't deny that that took place, do you?
As I stated, my recollection is vague about what we would have discussed about Tony at that meeting.
So you don't recall, but you are not saying that Larry Bach is mistaken?
That's correct.
And you only had one lunch with Larry Bach where you talked about Tony Zarnik. Isn't that right?
The intention of that lunch was not to talk about Tony Zarnik.
I'm not asking you about what the intention was. Isn't it correct you only had one lunch with Larry Bach where you and Larry Bach talked about Tony Zarnik?
I'll object that the question assumes facts not in evidence. The witness has already testified that he thinks it's possible they discussed Dr. Zarnik but doesn't have a clear recollection of it.
Overruled.
I believe I've only ever had lunch with Larry Bach once.
For the record, when you had lunch with Larry Bach, he was a board member, right?
That's correct.
Take a look at Exhibit 96. Do you recognize Exhibit 96, Mr. Flatley, as an expense report that you submitted in connection with your employment at Illumina?
I can't read that from here.
We'll blow it up. If you could look at the binder also, it's number 96. Do you recognize that, sir, as your signature on this document?
Yes.
Is there a copy of an expense report that you submitted?
I have no reason to doubt that that's what it is, no.
And one of the items reflected on this expense report was lunch, Larry Bach. Is that right?
Yes.
Go to the next page, please. Is the second page of Exhibit 96 a copy of the receipt that you submitted for that lunch with Larry Bach?
Appears to be, yes.
At the top, is that your writing where it says lunch, Larry Bach?
Yes.
What is the date of this lunch, sir?
November 4th, 1999.
November 4th, 1999. So approximately 2 weeks after your employment began.
Yes.
So that November 4th, 1999 lunch, again, that would have been the only lunch you ever had with Larry Bach?
To the best of my recollection, it is.
Is one of your board members a person named George Post?
Yes.
When did George Post join the Illumina Board of Directors?
I believe we elected him. I believe we elected him at the February meeting, which meant that his first meeting in attendance would have been the April meeting.
So he was elected at the February 2000 meeting?
Yes, I believe that's right.
Was George Post the first new member of the board of directors after you came on board as CEO?
I believe his start on the board of directors was contemporaneous with the changeout of Larry Bach with Chuck Hartman. So I believe those both occurred at the April board meeting. So Larry had resigned and was replaced by another member of CW Group.
Does George Post have some particular scientific background that you thought might be helpful to the company?
Yes, he has a lot of scientific background. But he was in a very high management position, so he's not doesn't do science day to day.
Did he run the research and development group of a pharmaceutical company?
Yes, he did.
You say he has... Strike that. When did you begin to recruit George Post to join the board of directors?
I had seen a press release saying that he was leaving his prior company, and shortly after that, I scheduled a breakfast meeting with him. And I believe that breakfast meeting might have happened in the September 99 timeframe.
Who else at Illumina, if anyone, participated in interviewing, meeting, and trying to recruit George Post to the board?
Well, I was really the person that was doing the assessment of George Post. In the breakfast meeting that we had with George, John and I were on a trip together, so John joined me for breakfast, and the meeting was in Palo Alto, and Mark Chi was up in Palo Alto for some other reason, so he joined us for lunch also.
You, Mark Chi, and John Stupnagel meet with George Post?
We had a breakfast meeting with George Post, yes.
Talk about him possibly joining the board of directors?
Yes.
Did you ever get your chief scientific officer, Tony Zarnik, involved in discussions with George Post about possibly joining the board?
No, this was not that sort of appointment. The board of directors are brought on board really for global business perspectives, their view of the industry, their view of the competition. Science input was not a factor in our selection of George Post.
I think I asked a simple question. Did you ever involve the chief science officer, Tony Zarnik, in any discussions with George Post about the board seat?
I involved Tony in a discussion about George joining the board. I did not ask Tony to meet with George.
Let's take a look, please, at Exhibit 111. You've seen this before, Mr. Flatley. This is the cover page to a slide presentation that you gave at the Hambricht and Quist Healthcare Conference on January 10th of 2000. Is that right?
That's right.
Tell the jury what this conference was.
Hambricht and Quist is an investment banking firm that brings together life science companies. In this conference to present, in about a 25-minute presentation, the technology and strategy of your company.
And you made that presentation on behalf of Illumina?
I did.
You used slides?
I did.
And was John Stupnagel present when you gave this presentation?
Yes.
Did he participate in making the presentation, or was he there to observe?
He was there to observe. I prepared the presentation.
Next page, please. This is one of the slides you showed at the H&Q conference, correct?
Yes.
Indicating the company was founded by John Stupnagel and Mark Chi. Is that correct?
Is what correct?
That you indicated on this slide the company was founded by John Stupnagel and Mark Chi.
That's right.
Now, I'm a little confused. Was this or was this not a mistake or an error on your part?
This was absolutely an error on my part.
You should have included Tony Zarnik.
On this slide at this presentation, I should have included Tony Zarnik.
How did you come to learn that the company had been founded by John Stupnagel and Mark Chi?
As I testified earlier, the concept of a founder is a very loose concept. During my early startup with the company, the founding group that... It seemed to me that the people that were founders were John and Mark. And at the time I did this presentation, to the best of my recollection, I was unaware that Tony had status as a founder. So I didn't include him on the slide, until he pointed that out to me.
Who told you that John Stupnagel and or Mark Chi were founders?
No one told me that specifically.
You didn't do any investigation or due diligence, ask any questions, look at any documents before you gave this presentation to find out who founded the company?
I didn't consider that necessary, no.
You had, in the process of doing due diligence on Illumina in deciding whether to join the company in the first place, you read their business plan, didn't you?
Very superficially. When I got the business plan, John told me it was largely out of date, so I believe I scanned the business plan, but I certainly didn't read it cover to cover.
This was the only business plan in place at Illumina, the one John Stupnagel gave you, right?
Yes.
You were taking over as the new CEO of the company at that point, true?
True.
Your testimony is that you only gave a superficial scan of the company's business plan?
The acting CEO at that time told me the data on the business plan was largely out of date. For that reason, my scan of the business plan was relatively superficial.
Aren't you aware the business plan was used in connection with the Series B financing?
The business plan was written in the summer of 1998, and so the concept of that business plan had evolved significantly by the fall of 1999.
You are aware now that Dr. Zarnik is listed as a founder in that business plan, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
You didn't see that when you were doing your superficial review?
If I did, I didn't recall it.
By the way, when John Stupnagel, who was at the H&Q conference, did he point out he had made an error on this slide?
No. The first time I knew there was an error here is when I received an email from Tony.
John Stupnagel never pointed out your error?
No.
And this, again, the timing of this was when you gave this presentation, was January of 2000?
That's correct.
Also in January of 2000, isn't it correct that you took away some important job responsibilities from Tony Zarnik?
I don't recall taking away any job responsibilities from Tony other than the routine reassignments that we look at every week in our senior staff meeting.
You took away from Dr. Zarnik the responsibility for making the decoding oligos, isn't that right?
It's possible that that happened. When you say I took it away, I would absolutely characterize it differently, if in fact that did happen. In staff meetings, we are constantly reviewing projects and priorities and who was working on what. We had center bandwidth, and it's possible Tony took on something different and we moved that to another person. But I have no specific recollection of the circumstances.
You were Tony Zarnik's boss at that point, January of 2000, right?
Yes.
So he reported directly to you?
Yes.
Mark Chi reported directly to you?
Yes.
Isn't it true that in January of 2000, I won't use takeaway, isn't it true in January of 2000, the responsibility for making decoding oligos was transferred from Tony Zarnik to Mark Chi?
That's possible. I mean, there could have been five other transfers as well. I don't remember exactly which projects were moving in what direction.
Let's talk about the oligator. The oligator is a significant thing that Illumina has at its disposal, true?
Yeah.
Probably could have used a better word.
Better word than thing? Yes. It's a great technology.
The oligator is a great technology. It's, in fact, something you mentioned specifically at the roadshow that we will talk about.
That's true.
And are you aware that Tony Zarnik was responsible for bringing Michael Leble, the person who invented that technology, to Illumina?
I wouldn't characterize it that way.
How would you characterize it, sir?
To my understanding, Tony introduced Michael Leble to the company, but John Stupnagel was responsible for bringing Michael Leble into the company.
Michael Leble reported to Tony Zarnik when he, I think, was chief science officer, isn't that right?
That's right.
So Tony Zarnik was responsible for supervising Michael Leble and the activities related to the oligator, true?
Yes.
And isn't it true that in January of 2000, you took that responsibility away from Tony Zarnik?
I believe that transition occurred when Tony stepped down from CEO to research fellow.
Are you sure or are you unsure of the timing of that?
That's my best recollection.
So if Dr. Zarnik were to say, in fact, I think he did say, it was in January of 2000 you took away responsibility for the oligator and Michael Leble, would you deny that?
I wouldn't deny it, but I would say it's unlikely.
Let me show you what we've marked Exhibit 178. Actually, I have a blow-up of it. Exhibit 178 is a copy of a document relating to Tony Zarnik's goals in January of 2000. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, it looks like that's what this is, yes.
And you included this document, this chart, reflecting Dr. Zarnik's goals and his progress toward goals. You included that in a board packet you submitted to Illumina's board of directors, is that right?
We often put goal status in the board packets, so we probably did.
This would have been for the board meeting in January 25th of 2000?
I believe the board meeting was in February of 2000.
I'm sorry, February of 2000. You are familiar that these color codings indicate the status of the various projects, true?
Would you like me to describe what the colors mean?
Yes. Generally, you are familiar with these, with this color scheme. Can you tell us what green means?
Yes. Green means that the person filling out the form anticipates that they will achieve the goal that shows green. If it's yellow, it means that there's some potential problem that's been identified in achieving that goal. If it's red, it means that it's unlikely they are going to meet it, or they are going to miss the date.
And if it's white, that means it's already been completed?
Yes.
Did you get any comments or questions from any of the board members when you submitted this as part of the board packet?
We don't review those in the board meetings.
You included this in the board packet, but didn't discuss it. Is that what you were saying?
That's right. It could potentially come up in the discussion that that particular individual had on their report to the board on their department. So it's possible that any of the VPs could throw that slide up in the board meeting and talk about it in context of their department report. But we don't go through a section of the board meeting where we say, let's look at all the goals and compare things.
Bottom line, do you recall any questions or discussion about Tony Zarnik's goals and his progress toward goals at the February 2000 board meeting?
We had just set those goals, so there was no really meaningful information on that chart because all, you know, virtually everybody's goals are green when you first set them because you are just defining what the goal is. And of course, immediately after that, you still believe you can make most of them.
Let me request the court reporter read the question back. I'd like you to answer this question.
You claim it's not responsive?
I do, Judge.
Do you object to that?
I think it was responsive.
Let's hear it. You may answer. You want to re-ask the question?
Sure. Was there any discussion at the February 2000 board meeting with respect to Exhibit 178, Dr. Zarnik's goals and his progress toward those?
I don't recall any specific discussion.
Do you recall a dinner meeting with Tony Zarnik that took place on February 7th, 2000, at a restaurant called Daly's?
Yes.
Now, you specifically asked Tony Zarnik about his depression at this lunch, didn't you?
First off, this was a dinner, not a lunch.
Thanks. Let me ask a clear question. Isn't it true, sir, that this dinner meeting on February 7th, 2000... that you specifically asked Tony Zarnik about his depression?
I didn't know Tony Zarnik had depression at that time.
So you deny making any reference to depression?
Yes.
Did you make any comments or did you ask any questions related in any way to mental health?
No.
Did you ask Tony Zarnik if you thought his depression was caused by work?
I already testified that I didn't know Tony Zarnik had depression, so such a question would have been impossible.
You do recall asking Tony Zarnik at this dinner whether he was willing to give up his CSO title.
Yes.
And you asked Tony Zarnik whether it was critical to him that he keep a management position with the company?
The way the conversation went, Tony, in effect, early on, when I was at Illumina, put out a standing offer to step down as CSO. So I didn't directly ask him, will you step down as CSO? He had kind of made that as a standing offer. So we discussed his stepping down from CSO. And yes, I did ask him if having a management component in whatever position we defined after that was of importance to him.
You essentially asked him, was his offer to step down still on the table?
In effect.
And isn't it true that Dr. Zarnik told you that he would accept a non-management role if it were an important high-level position with the company?
No, that's not how the conversation went.
Isn't it true that Dr. Zarnik told you he was still very excited about the company at that point in time?
Yes.
And isn't it true he told you he still wanted very much to contribute to the company at that point in time?
Yes.
And at that point in time, February 7th of 2000, you told Tony Zarnik you thought he could still be a valuable contributor to Illumina, true?
I may have said that. I certainly hoped he could.
Was there any discussion, sir, at this point, about any changes or reductions to Dr. Zarnik's compensation?
No.
At this dinner, February 7th, 2000, Dr. Zarnik specifically requested that he be asked to participate and help in the search for any new CSO. True?
I believe he did bring it up at that dinner, yes.
This wasn't the first time he had brought it up, was it? That he wanted to be involved in any search for a new CSO.
Well, I guess it's possible he would have said that prior to that dinner meeting, but we really hadn't discussed him specifically stepping down from the CSO position until that dinner, so I would be surprised, but it's possible.
What did you say to Dr. Zarnik on February 7th of 2000, when he asked to be included in helping to find a new CSO?
I told him I would involve him in the process.
Did you tell him that 3 days earlier you had already spoken to David Barker about a position at Illumina?
I did not.
Approximately 3 weeks later, on March 1st, 2000, you told Tony Zarnik he was no longer CSO. Is that right?
That's correct.
And on that same day, you told Tony Zarnik the new CSO was David Barker?
No.
Did you mention David Barker?
Yes.
What did you say?
I told him that David Barker was scheduled to come in for interviews on the next day. I asked him to coordinate those interviews. Would he set up a seminar, coordinate the schedule of David Barker beginning with the following day?
When did David Barker start working as a consultant or an employee?
His first day as a consultant was our all-hands meeting, which was in, I would estimate that to be the second week of March. And that was a half-day consulting assignment, where we introduced him to our investment bankers. His full-time start was some 7 to maybe 10 days after that. He began helping with the drafting of the S-1.
Didn't you start David Barker as a consultant on March 6th of 2000?
Whatever the day of the organization meeting was the day he started as a consultant.
Now, on March 1st, 2000, when you told Tony Zarnik he was no longer CSO, on that same day, you told him that there were going to be changes to his compensation. Is that right?
In the same meeting, yes.
And you had decided unilaterally to reduce Dr. Zarnik's compensation, right?
That's correct.
And you were reducing both his salary and his stock. Is that right?
That's right.
And in terms of reducing Tony Zarnik's stock, you weren't talking about just changing the vesting rate, the rate at which the shares vest. You were talking about actually buying back significant numbers of shares from Dr. Zarnik, weren't you?
That's really a semantics issue. We were, in effect, saying that from this point forward, you would be eligible to vest a smaller number in total than you had been previously eligible to vest. And you could characterize that in multiple different ways.
Perhaps we'll look at the agreement that you asked Dr. Zarnik to sign, but isn't it true that you were telling him that the company was going to immediately buy back a significant number of shares at a penny a share?
Those were shares that he had not vested in, so we were buying back shares that were unvested shares.
Shares he might acquire in the future if he continued to be employed.
Shares he would earn a right to keep if he continued employment with Illumina.
If he didn't quit or wasn't fired.
That's correct.
Now, your reasoning for deciding that the company was going to buy back some shares, the reasoning was the fact that Dr. Zarnik was taking on a new position of research fellow. Is that right?
There were several components in my decision. That was one of them.
Let me read your deposition testimony. Page 132, line 11. And this is your sworn deposition testimony. And what was your reason for reducing Dr. Zarnik's stock?
Because that level of stock was consistent with his new role in the company as a research fellow.
Is Mark Chi the only other research fellow that's ever been employed at Illumina?
To my knowledge, yes.
Let's take a look, please, at Exhibit 148. Mr. Flatley, this is an email you sent to Tony Zarnik on March 21st of 2000. Is that right?
Yes.
Forwarding on a change of position agreement, correct?
Correct.
Next page, please. This is the actual change of position agreement you were asking Dr. Zarnik to sign?
Yes.
And in paragraph 3, this agreement would provide that Dr. Zarnik agrees that the company shall repurchase 167,000 shares of his common stock at a price of a penny a share. Is that right?
Exactly the price he paid for that stock, yes.
Tony Zarnik refused to sign this agreement. Is that right?
He did.
And your lawyers, your company lawyers, told you that it would be illegal to change Dr. Zarnik's stock unless he signed such an agreement.
Objection, argumentative.
Overruled.
Lawyers never use the word illegal.
They told you you couldn't legally do it?
What my lawyers told me was a reduction in this stock needed to be mutual between the employee and the company. And so we drafted an agreement to memorialize such an agreement between Dr. Zarnik and the company.
And your state of mind, sir, was if your lawyers told you it was legally permissible, you would have reduced Tony Zarnik's stock at that point in time without his consent?
Objection. Calls for speculation. Assumes facts not in evidence.
Sustained.
Goes to state of mind, Judge.
It's a hypothetical question to a non-expert witness. Sustained.
Also for the record, I'd like to make the record that the communications to which Mr. Flatley just testified were not held with current counsel and therefore do not constitute a waiver of any attorney-client privilege between my law firm and Mr. Flatley and Illumina.
This would be a good time for a morning break, if it's all right.
We'll take our morning recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 10:45. Please remember the admonition not to form or express any opinions about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 10:45. Is there something you wanted to discuss?
No, I just thought it would be a good time for the break.
Okay.
I have about 50 minutes gone on my clock, Judge.
Okay, the record will indicate all the jurors present, counsel and parties present. You may continue your examination, Mr. Pantone.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to take a look at Exhibit 164, Mr. Flatley. The top email. You recognize this as an email that you received from Tony Zarnik on April 3rd, 2000?
Yes.
And toward the bottom here, Dr. Zarnik claims, "Every aspect of my original contract has been reduced in a manner I consider discriminatory and punitive." Correct?
That's correct reading, yes.
And you say that you didn't know yet at this point in time he was talking about discrimination on the basis of medical condition. Is that right?
That's right.
Let's take a look at another email, please. 173. You recognize Exhibit 173, Mr. Flatley? A copy of an email you received from Tony Zarnik on April 5th of 2000?
Yes.
Now, at the last paragraph, Dr. Zarnik makes specific reference to discrimination based on my medical condition. So at least by this date, April 5th of 2000, you knew that Dr. Zarnik was making some sort of a claim that he was discriminated against on the basis of his medical condition. Is that right?
Yes. It was very clear that he had a medical condition from this, and he thought the change of compensation was discriminatory.
So, as of April 5th, you knew that the discrimination he was talking about was, in his mind, medical condition discrimination.
Yes.
Let's take a look at 185, please. At the bottom of this page, do you recognize this as an April 18th, 2000 email that you sent to Tony Zarnik?
Yes.
And in that email, you tell Dr. Zarnik, "Any issues you have had with John are history and are not in my mind at all related to our current discussions," right?
That's correct. Correct reading. Yes.
Do you recognize the email on top of that to be an email from Tony Zarnik to you the same day, April 18th, 2000, responding to your email?
Yes.
In this email, Dr. Zarnik points out to you that he believes that the discrimination that he experienced was before you arrived and after you arrived, correct?
Yes.
And you received this back in April, on April 18th, 2000, right?
Yes.
At this point in time, Mr. Flatley, did you know specifically what Dr. Zarnik was referring to in terms of what happened before you arrived?
Well, I'm not sure exactly when I pieced that all together. I began having some discussions with John about what had predated my arrival, and that covered the year and a half's worth of time, so I'm not sure what pieces I had at any given time. But I was beginning to collect pieces of information.
You never asked Tony Zarnik what he was referring to as discrimination before you arrived, did you?
I did not.
Exhibit 222, please.
I'm sorry, 222?
222. And we've seen this email before. I want to confirm that you received this. Did you receive a copy of this? Strike that. Did you receive this May 19th, 2000?
May 17th.
I better let you do the reading.
Is there a question there?
I want to make it clear on the record. Exhibit 222 is an email dated May 17th of 2000 from Tony Zarnik to you. You did, in fact, receive this email, did you not?
I assume I did, yeah.
And you knew that on this date, Tony Zarnik was going down to the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing for an interview, right?
Right.
And you knew that Dr. Zarnik was going to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing to talk about discrimination, right?
All I knew is that he was going down there for an interview.
You didn't know that it had to do with alleged discrimination?
That would have been an inference on my part, so I didn't know anything about it. I had no experience with a DFEH. I didn't know anything about what his intent was. If you piece together some prior emails, someone might infer that, but I didn't know anything about this.
And Exhibit 231, please. Exhibit 231 is a copy of a May 22, 2000 letter from the Department of Fair Employment and Housing to you, Jay Flatley. You did receive this letter, did you not, from the DFEH?
Yes.
And this letter enclosed a copy of Dr. Zarnik's actual complaint of discrimination against Illumina, right?
Yes.
Now I want to show you a portion of Exhibit 304. You can look in your binder first, Mr. Flatley, and tell us what Exhibit 304 is.
This is a letter delivered to Mr. Jose Moreno at the Department of Fair Employment and Housing that was prepared by our attorneys in response to the allegations that Mr. Zarnik had submitted.
This was prepared by Jennifer Kearns, your attorney?
That's correct.
And do you understand this to be submitted to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing as Illumina's response to Dr. Zarnik's complaint of discrimination?
Yes.
And this is a segment that we have up on screen here from page 15 of Illumina's response to the DFEH. And it reads, Illumina notes that Dr. Zarnik did not follow its internal complaint procedures. He did not voice a complaint of discrimination or harassment orally or in writing to the Human Resources Department, but instead proceeded directly to file with the department, perhaps advising co-workers days beforehand that he was planning to do so. Dr. Zarnik never lodged any internal complaint in a manner which would have afforded Illumina the chance to address his concerns outside the administrative forum. That's not a true statement, is it?
Dr. Zarnik never, to my knowledge, filed a complaint with our Human Resources Department.
But he told you he felt he was discriminated against, didn't he?
He sent me an email saying that he had been discriminated in his change of compensation.
He sent you several emails. We just looked at them. Dealing with discrimination before he filed this actual charge with the DFEH, correct?
That's correct.
Do you agree with this statement? Dr. Zarnik never lodged any internal complaint in a manner which would have afforded Illumina the chance to address his concerns outside the administrative forum.
The context of this is that Dr. Zarnik had resigned his position. We were in severance negotiations.
Let me stop you and move to strike. I want to know whether you move to strike that. I want to know whether he agrees with this statement.
Can you answer that question? You may answer the question. Do you agree with that statement?
The last sentence, which reads, Dr. Zarnik never lodged any internal complaint in a manner that would have afforded Illumina the chance to address his concerns outside the administrative forum.
You don't have to confine your answer to yes or no. You can explain your answer.
To me, it's parsing words, the definition of the word complaint. To me, a complaint is a process. We had a procedure in the company for filing complaints on discrimination, where what Dr. Zarnik did was not something that followed company procedures. It was an email directly to me related to a change in compensation that I instituted with regards to Dr. Zarnik.
We looked at an email that said part of what he was complaining about was what Dr. Stupnagel did before you arrived.
Objection, argumentative.
Sustained.
Isn't it true, sir, you understood that Dr. Zarnik was also complaining about things that happened to him while John Stupnagel was his supervisor?
Yes, by this time I did understand that.
Now, with respect to this response, you understood that was being sent to a government agency. The California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, didn't you?
Yes.
and you reviewed and approved this response before it was sent to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing.
I reviewed the response, but the principal input to this was not from me.
Did you review and approve the letter before it was sent out?
Yes, I did.
And you provided input into the content of the letter, is that right?
I provided some input.
And you authorized it to be sent on to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing, is that right?
Is that a different question than the prior one?
Yes.
How is it different?
Did you authorize Ms. Kearns to send this response on behalf of Illumina to the Department of Fair Employment and Housing?
I believe I answered that I did.
Now, Mr. Flatley, do you recall a series of... Take this off. Do you recall a series of severance negotiations regarding a possible severance package for Tony Zarnik?
Yes.
Objection, vague as to time.
Well, he may lay a foundation.
Over what period did you have discussions with Dr. Zarnik with respect to a possible severance package?
It began in about the third week of March of 2000, and it went up to and included his termination.
At some point, Mr. Flatley, before you assigned your goals, the 30, 60, 90-day goals to Dr. Zarnik, did you and Dr. Zarnik reach an impasse in your severance negotiations?
Let me first point out, those were not my goals. Those were Tony's goals. We did reach a point where we were still apart and had not converged on an agreement, yes.
Did there reach a point you felt there had been an impasse in negotiations?
I think that's fair to say.
Approximately when was that, sir?
That would have been in the early part of May.
At some point before you assigned Dr. Zarnik his 30, 60, 90-day goals, is that right?
Before we revised his goals to the final set, yes.
Before you actually assigned them to him?
Well, Dr. Zarnik had been working as a research fellow since March 1st, and so there were goals that had already been discussed to some extent prior to that. And I had expected between March 1st and the beginning part of May that Dr. Zarnik was doing something productive related to his goals. It was unclear that that was the case. In fact, in retrospect, there was nothing productive going on, but by that time of early May, his ultimate final set of goals had not been assigned.
The ultimate final set of goals was assigned on May 19th, 2000. Is that right?
That's right.
And you reached an impasse in negotiations prior to May 2000. Is that right?
I think that's fair to say.
Now, in terms of what you offered to Dr. Zarnik in the way of severance, at one point you offered Dr. Zarnik a package of 6 months' salary and 6 months' stock vesting. Is that right?
That's right.
Do you recall that at some point David Walt from the board got involved in the severance negotiations?
Yes.
And Dr. Walt offered Tony Zarnik 9 months' salary, 9 months' stock vesting. Is that your understanding?
David Walt offered that as a representative of the board of directors.
On behalf of Illumina?
Yes.
Do you recall a point in time where David Walt told you that he had reached consensus with Tony Zarnik with respect to a package that would include 9 months' stock vesting, if Dr. Zarnik could sit on the scientific advisory board and get additional stock vesting?
No, there's no such consensus. David Walt told me that discussion had occurred during the meeting, but there was never any consensus on that.
Okay. Let's talk about the research fellow position. That's the position that Dr. Zarnik assumed after CSO, right?
Right.
And the research fellow position at that point in time was a newly created position at Illumina. Is that right?
That's right.
And when Dr. Zarnik took over as research fellow, there were no written goals in place at that time, correct, for that position?
That's correct.
Would you agree, Mr. Flatley, that Dr. Zarnik's duties and responsibilities as a research fellow were primarily scientific in nature?
Yes.
Would you agree that his responsibilities as a research fellow were quite different from the responsibilities he had as chief science officer?
Yes. Although I would clarify that the goals that Tony originally submitted had lots of other responsibilities on them that were not primarily scientific. Those were ultimately deleted from the goals. So the early proposal on the goals included non-scientific responsibilities like organizing intern programs and things like that. The ultimate goals were primarily scientific.
In terms of discussing the position and your view of the position, rather than specific goals, let's focus on your understanding of the position. You understood that the position of research fellow involved duties and responsibilities that were quite different from duties and responsibilities of the scientific officer. Is that right?
Yes.
And as research fellow, did Dr. Zarnik have any further management responsibilities?
No.
Did he have any employees that he was supposed to supervise?
No.
Did he have no responsibility relating in any way to the Scientific Advisory Board, SAB?
No direct responsibilities, no.
Did Dr. Zarnik, as research fellow, have any responsibilities in the area of business development?
No.
Or financial planning?
Financial planning, to the extent that his goals required an analysis of budgets, costs, things of that nature. That type of financial planning was definitely still part of his responsibility.
But not corporate-level financial planning?
Well, he didn't have that responsibility as CSO either.
Now, after Dr. Zarnik became a research fellow, he reported initially to your chief scientific officer, David Barker. Is that right?
That's right.
That was your decision to have Dr. Zarnik as research fellow report to the chief science officer, right?
Yes.
And is it true that you initially had Dr. Zarnik report to Dr. Barker because Tony Zarnik's job responsibilities were primarily scientific?
David Barker, yeah. He was the new CSO coming into the company. We expected Tony to be working on scientific projects, and initially it made sense to have him reporting to David as a result.
Did you have any formal training, Mr. Flatley, in chemistry, molecular biology, or any other branch of science?
By formal, do you mean if I have a PhD? I do not.
Do you have any degrees in any of those areas?
Not specifically those areas, no.
You would agree you certainly have less scientific background and experience than David Barker.
Yes.
How long did Tony Zarnik report as research fellow to the chief science officer, David Barker?
My guess is it would have been about 6 weeks, something of that nature.
And after 6 weeks of having Tony Zarnik report to David Barker, you changed the reporting relationship, right?
Right.
You did that on May 4th, 2000, is that right?
That's approximately the time frame.
Let's take a look at Exhibit 214. Is Exhibit 214 a copy of an email you sent to everyone at the company on May 4th, 2000?
Looks like that, yes.
So you'd agree that the effective date of the transfer of Tony Zarnik's reporting relationship from Dr. Barker to yourself was May 4th, 2000?
Yes.
At this time, May 4th, 2000, did you have any other scientists who reported directly to you?
Yes.
Who was that?
David Barker reported to me. Michael Lebla reported to me at this time. Mark Chi had reported to me. But with David coming on, I reassigned Mark to report to David. So I supervised Mark Chi's activities since I joined the company in October. John Stupnagel had some science training as well. So some people would call him a scientist. Some might not.
Mark Chi in May of 2000 was reporting to David Barker?
When David Barker came on board, Mark Chi started reporting to David.
When Tony Zarnik was a research fellow, did you ask him to attend meetings of your senior staff?
No.
You held meetings of your senior staff, didn't you?
Yes.
How regularly did you hold those meetings?
Every week.
Why did you not invite Tony Zarnik to the regular weekly staff meetings that you held?
Because his position wasn't one that related to the types of topics we discuss at our senior staff meetings. There were many people that reported to me that didn't attend my senior staff meeting. It was really the vice presidents who ran departments that reported that attended those senior staff meetings.
As research fellow, did you consider Dr. Zarnik to continue to be a member of your senior management team?
No.
Did he continue to participate in strategic planning for the company?
No.
Now, on the same day that you changed Dr. Zarnik's reporting relationship, you gave him a counseling memo. Isn't that right?
I believe that's right.
Let's look at Exhibit 206, please. Is this a copy of the counseling memo you gave Tony Zarnik on May 4th of 2000?
Yes.
Mr. Flatley, To your knowledge, is there anything negative in Dr. Zarnik's personnel file? Strike that. Was there any counseling memo, to your knowledge, in Dr. Zarnik's personnel file before you gave him this May 4th, 2000 memo?
Objection. Lacks foundation.
Sustained.
Do you know either way, sir, whether there was anything negative in Dr. Zarnik's personnel file prior to May 4th, 2000?
Same objection.
Overruled.
The counseling sessions with Tony had been largely verbal up to this point, so this may have been the first time that there was documented criticism of his performance in a written form.
Are you aware, sir, of anything documenting any alleged performance problems on the part of Tony Zarnik before May 4th, 2000?
Sure. There's lots of notes and things like that of that nature. Tremendous compilation of notes and background about Tony's performance that never wound up in his personnel file.
Was there anything, to your knowledge, given to Dr. Zarnik alleging poor performance prior to May 4th, 2000?
There was great feedback given to him verbally.
Anything in writing, to your knowledge?
No.
Now, in the second paragraph of your May 4th, 2000 memo, you state that you had been informed over the last few months by two individuals that Dr. Zarnik had a historical pattern of leaving the facility for extended periods when John Stupnagel or yourself were absent. Was one of those persons, one of the two individuals who informed you of that, Deborah Flamino?
Yes.
Are you sure of that?
To the best of my recollection, yes.
And who was the second individual?
I believe it might have been Connie Brick, but there might have been others as well.
Where did you have this discussion with Deborah Flamino, where she told you about this alleged historical pattern?
This was a very well-known pattern of Dr. Zarnik's prior to this. It was not a meeting where she disclosed that to me. Over many, many months, people had told me about Dr. Zarnik's leaving the facility, being gone for extended periods of time, particularly during the time of that the other senior managers were traveling.
I'm asking with respect to Deborah Flamino. Are you saying she told you about this historical pattern of leaving the facility, that she, Deborah Flamino, told you that on more than one occasion?
I believe that's the case, yes.
Now, Dr. Zarnik asked you for some specifics with respect to this claim that he had been historically absent from the facility. He asked you for some date, for some further detail, didn't he?
I believe there's a response memo to this memo where Tony asked for information.
Did you ever provide Dr. Zarnik with any specifics?
I provided him with a response to his email, yes.
Did you ever provide him with any specifics in terms of the alleged times that he was absent from the facility?
I provided him a general response regarding that issue, not a specific one.
Provide any dates or times?
No.
Let's talk about the written goals that were assigned to Dr. Zarnik as research fellow. Were you aware that Dr. Zarnik and David Barker were discussing a set of written goals for Tony Zarnik as research fellow while Dr. Barker was still his supervisor?
I was aware that Tony had submitted a draft set of goals to David Barker.
My question, sir, were you aware that Dr. Barker and Tony Zarnik had had some discussions about a written set of goals?
I believe that they had had one or two discussions about the goals.
And in fact, at some point, David Barker, Tony Zarnik, and you met to talk about written goals while Dr. Barker was still Tony Zarnik's supervisor. Is that right?
I don't have any recollection of that meeting. None at all.
Let's look, please, at Exhibit 227. Is Exhibit 227 a copy of the final goals that you assigned to Tony Zarnik as research fellow?
Yes.
And is that your writing at the top of the document where it says Tony's file?
Yes.
Is that your writing at the bottom where it says 519, discussed and given to Tony at meeting?
Yes.
So did you in fact give these written goals to Tony Zarnik on May 19th of 2000?
Yes, I did.
And you recognize that this is the next day after Tony Zarnik had visited the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing?
519 would be the next day, yes.
Is it correct, sir, that you and John Stupnagel and Mark Chi and David Barker All four of you met together in a conference room at Illumina to discuss the set of goals that would be assigned to Tony Czarnik?
I'm not at all certain where we met. I had interactions with all three of them in the formation of the goals, yes.
You do recall at least one meeting at Illumina where the four of you were present at the same time. Yourself, Dr. Stupnagel, Dr. Chi, and Dr. Barker, to talk about assigning goals to Tony Czarnik. Is that right?
I don't remember a meeting necessarily where all four of us were together at once. These evolved over some period that had begun in early March, so when it was clear that Tony was... he had resigned at the end of March, and when we had reached an impasse on the negotiations, we needed to get the goals in place. We had had multiple meetings between us establishing what those goals should be and what was appropriate.
Mr. Flatley, when you gave these goals to Tony Czarnik on May 19th of 2000, you knew he wasn't going to be able to meet these goals, isn't that right?
That's not right.
You had already formed the intention to terminate Dr. Czarnik's employment as of May 19th, 2000. Isn't that true?
Not at all. If I had that impression, I would have fired him right then.
You knew you were going to end up firing him at some point after you gave him the goals, didn't you?
My objective was to do everything I possibly could to make Tony a productive member of Illumina. I had absolutely no intention of firing him if he was a productive member of the Illumina team.
Looking at these specific goals on Exhibit 227, the second goal dealing with binary oligo encoding, Illumina had never worked on this area before May of 2000. Isn't that right?
We had never done any experiments in this area. We intellectually talked about this concept.
You were asking Dr. Czarnik to do experiments in the area of binary oligo encoding, right?
Right.
The company had never done that before, correct?
If we had done it before, we wouldn't need to set a goal to do it again.
You hadn't even started any experiments in the area of binary oligo encoding.
No. That's why it was such a great opportunity.
The method for decoding that was being used at Illumina in that point in time had been the method invented by Mark Chi, right?
We'd explored multiple methods of decoding. There were lots of different theories how to do it. Most effectively, the method that was being used regularly in manufacturing at this point was the method that Mark Chi had invented. But there were lots of different methods proposed.
As you understand it, the 16-bead decoding experiment was done using Mark Chi's method of decoding. Is that right?
That's right.
And the 128-bead experiment had been done using Mark Chi's method of decoding. Is that right?
Yes.
The 768 decoding experiment was done using Mark Chi's method, right?
Correct.
You are still using Mark Chi's method to do decoding today?
It's one method. We're working on more than one.
Mark Chi's method is the method you are using, certainly for purposes of manufacturing.
That's correct.
As of the date you gave Dr. Czarnik these goals, May 19th of 2000, how many different bead types could Illumina actually decode at that point in time?
What do you mean by actually?
That you were able to do it on a repeatable, verifiable, regular basis.
We were in the several hundred range in terms of numbers of codes.
200 or so?
Varied from experiment to experiment. We would have some that would be 50 or 100, others which might be 300. So we were doing lots of experiments on decoding at this time.
Is it fair to say the range was between 2 and 300?
I think so.
Now, is it correct, sir, that on the third line of these goals, that somebody suggested that a goal of submitting a grant application be added to Dr. Czarnik's goals?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
We had seen the prior drafts before. I don't think I need to put them up. You are aware the prior drafts of goals that were discussed with David Barker for this particular project did not mention a grant application, right?
I'm aware of that now. At the time, that wasn't a major issue, so...
Who suggested adding on to goal number 3 a goal to write a grant application?
I'm not sure.
At this point in time, May of 2000, did you know that Dr. Czarnik had suffered a breakdown at a time that he was writing a grant application?
Yes, but I also knew the breakdown was unrelated to the grant application.
I'm sorry. Did you know as of May 2000 that Dr. Czarnik had previously suffered a breakdown when he was writing a grant application?
I did, and I knew it was unrelated to the grant application.
By the way, on the subject of the grant application that Dr. Zarnik was working on April of 1999, did John Stuepnagel tell you that Tony Zarnik did not complete that grant application and did not submit it on time?
No, I don't recall him telling me that at all.
Let me read from your deposition testimony at page 82, beginning on line 9. Did Dr. Stuepnagel tell you essentially that, you know, Tony Zarnik had dropped the ball on this grant application that he was working on at the time?
He told me that Tony had not completed the grant application on schedule.
Did he tell you he was upset about that? He, Dr. Stuepnagel, was upset about Dr. Zarnik's not delivering the grant application at that time?
He told me that he was disappointed that Tony hadn't delivered per his commitment, yes.
You know now, sir, Dr. Zarnik did complete the grant application, and it was submitted on time, don't you?
I'd be delighted to clarify my testimony on that if you'd like me to.
Go ahead.
So, at the time of the deposition, I didn't know exactly what the dates were that it was due, that it had to be mailed, all those pieces of information. In my deposition, you asked me, did I know whether the grant was ever finished? And I testified that I was unaware whether it had ever gotten finished at that point in time. So, when you asked me, what did John Stuepnagel tell me about whether he finished it on time? Because there was this big event surrounding that grant, my assumption was the grant was due right at that point in time when this big event occurred, which has turned out not to be the case. It was due some weeks later, and Tony finished the grant. So that was information I didn't have at my deposition.
So did Dr. Stuepnagel tell you that Tony Zarnik had not completed the grant application on schedule, and he was disappointed about that?
I just testified that I don't recollect that John told me that, but my assumption was the grant was due at the time this event occurred during my deposition. And I've learned subsequently the grant was not due during the day of the breakdown. It was due some weeks later.
Look at Exhibit 263, please. Did you receive this email, Mr. Flatley, from Tony Zarnik on or about July 10th, 2000?
By this time, we had begun the roadshow, so my email was highly sporadic during the roadshow. I couldn't testify which date I actually saw this or read it.
At some point, did you see it?
Yes.
And in this email, Dr. Zarnik states, "The primary issue for us to discuss now is how our reporting relationship can go forward, following my learning that you told the board in April that I would not be successful in achieving my goals." Did you ever respond to this email?
No. It was an outright lie, so I had no reason to respond to it.
Just ignored it?
I ignored it.
Could you tell the jury what an S-1 registration statement is?
Sure. When a company intends to go public, they have to file a series of documents with the SEC to do that. The first one that you file is called a registration statement. It's called a S-1 document. It's a fairly lengthy document that describes the company, the financials of the company, background, history, things of that nature. And you do a series of these filings up until you go public. You start typically with an S-1 that gets reviewed by the SEC. They comment back, you review it, and there's this iterative process back and forth that winds up with a final document called a red herring that you go to the roadshow with to hand to the investors. The S-1 is the first one, and there are lots of iterations.
Were you the person with primary responsibility for the S-1 statement on the Illumina team?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by primary. There were lots of people contributing to the document. If you are asking who wrote most of the words, who had final authority for the document, I did.
And you personally reviewed and commented on each draft of the S-1. Isn't that right?
That's probably not the case. There are many, many iterations and drafts back and forth between the lawyers. I mean, hundreds of these. And so, no, I can't say I read every one and commented on every one.
Most of them. Is that fair to say?
I would say, actually, not most of them. There are many, many iterations that I probably never even saw.
Would you agree that the drafting of the S-1 registration statement was the most important project going on at Illumina from a business standpoint?
Boy, that's hard to say. It was clearly important, but we have the ABI project going at the same time, which, from a business perspective, was very important. If our IPO had gotten delayed 9 months and the market was good, then that timing of the S-1 submission could have been irrelevant. So That still is speculative on how important it was.
Would you agree it was one of the most important projects coming online?
Sure. It commanded lots of our attention.
In terms of who was involved in the process of reviewing and commenting on the S1 registration statement from Illumina's point of view, that would include yourself, right?
Yes.
And John Stupnagel?
Yes.
And Mark Chi?
Mark Chi was selectively involved.
Did Tony Czarnik request that he be allowed to participate in the review and editing of the S1?
I don't know about editing, but Tony asked to see it, and we gave him copies early on of the S1 drafts.
Why was Tony Czarnik not included in any of the meetings where S1 drafts were reviewed and discussed?
Because there was no need to include Dr. Czarnik. We needed to have lots of people at Illumina doing real work, and the S1 had no scientific content, so there was no reason to bring Dr. Czarnik into the meetings.
The S1 had no scientific content?
No, it's a business document. The goal of an S1 drafting is to remove scientific content, not to put it in.
Why was David Barker included in reviewing and commenting on the drafts of the S1?
A couple of reasons. One, that David had direct experience writing an S1 previously and knew what it took and how it interacted with the lawyers on drafting an S1. So he was directly experienced in this. Since he had worked for me before, I knew he was an outstanding writer, one of the best I'd ever seen. And thirdly, I was planning to take David Barker on the roadshow with me, so having intimate knowledge of the content of the S1, helping to generate, would be very valuable as part of the roadshow exercise.
Mark Chi had never had any prior experience reviewing and commenting on S1s, did he?
No.
Mark Chi wasn't going to the roadshow, was he?
No. That's why I didn't involve him directly in the project.
But Mark Chi was involved in reviewing to some degree and commenting on the S1.
Mark got some copies of the S1, but he was very selectively involved on particular topics that Mark had expertise in.
Let's take a look at Exhibit 153. Do you recognize Exhibit 153 as a draft of a section of the S1?
Yes. I don't know which draft it was, but it looks like a draft.
It indicates at the top this is a description of the directors and executive officers as of March 15, 2000.
That's correct.
And at least on this draft, Dr. Czarnik was included, correct?
Correct.
Was Dr. Czarnik a director or executive officer as of March 15, 2000?
No, he was not.
Why was he included in this chart?
Well, you'll have to settle the context for me in terms of whether this was which draft it was. There were literally probably hundreds of versions of this. I can't comment specifically on this one until I knew where it was in a time sequence.
We know at least it was sometime after David Barker joined the company, correct?
David joined right at the time we were starting the process.
So this draft is sometime after David Barker came on board as chief scientific officer, correct?
Yes, that would be correct.
So that means that when this draft was prepared, if David Barker was chief scientific officer, then Tony Czarnik was research fellow, right?
Yeah, it depends again on the timing, because David Barker officially... What was his official start date? I'd have to look back to see exactly when his first paycheck was as an employee. He had consulted in the beginning, around March 6, so it could be that as of the time we did this, we knew he was going to be joining, but he hadn't actually. So, again, it depends on the timing.
Looking at Dr. Czarnik's name on this draft of S1, he is specifically called a research fellow, right?
Right.
So if he was a research fellow and not a director or executive officer, why was he included in this chart?
Well, if this is the final version, as an example, Dr. Czarnik requested that he be included in the list.
This is a version, if we scroll down to John Stupnagel's description, this is a version where John Stupnagel is described as founding Illumina. Mark Chi is described as founding Illumina. The next page. Tony Czarnik is described as having helped found Illumina. Do you know why his role was distinguished from Dr. Stupnagel's and Dr. Chi's role?
Well, like I said, there were many, many versions of this, and this could have been drafted by Brian Roberts, who we asked to help us, from one of the venture capital firms. And Tony had a position of research fellow as of the first. So It's possible Brian wrote that language in an attempt to distinguish him from who was an executive officer, who wasn't. If Connie did that, it could have been for some other reason. I don't know who generated this draft.
Let's take a look, please, at Exhibit 223. If you could look in your binder, too, sir, that might be helpful.
223.
223. Looking at the cover page, do you recognize this as a fax that you received on or about May 18th of 2000?
I was on the distribution list for this fax, yes, if it was a fax. It looks like it was a fax.
So does it appear to be a fax that you received at some point in time?
Yes.
Let's move to the 12th page of this exhibit. There are numbers in the lower right-hand corner. Do you recognize this as a markup of a draft of the S-1 registration statement?
I do recognize it, yes. I'm not sure I ever saw this, but I recognize it now as a draft, yes.
And if we could move, please, to Exhibit 29. Page 29, in the lower right-hand corner. By the way, you don't deny receiving this. It was produced by your counsel in this case. You're saying you don't recall?
I don't recall.
Look at the Bates stamp number.
Produced by our counsel. You mean produced in connection with the litigation, not in connection with the IPO?
I'm sorry, this was a document produced by your counsel in connection with this lawsuit?
I assume that's the case, yeah.
You don't deny receiving it. You just say you don't recall specifically. Is that right?
What I'm saying is that there were... these faxes were going back and forth between the attorneys of the underwriters, literally 10 or 20 a day, and it's very unlikely I even looked at this document. And literally, these were not things I was reviewing at this level. These were details between the lawyers.
Between which lawyers?
Between our lawyers and... Between Sullivan and Campbell, attorneys for the underwriters, and our lawyers.
Your lawyers being Illumina's lawyers?
Illumina's lawyers connected with the IPO, yes.
Next page, page 30 of the exhibit. So at least... By this point in time, May of 2000, it appears Dr. Zarnik was included as being one of the company's founders. Is that right?
Yes, it looks that way.
You don't quarrel with that? You agree Dr. Zarnik is one of Illumina's founders, don't you?
Yes.
If we could scroll through the rest of the pages, 31 through the end, 43, this is just a markup of the S-1 registration statement?
Yes, a markup by the attorneys of the underwriters.
Let me ask you some questions about the Illumina Roadshow. First of all, you went on a vacation. I think you said it was a working vacation, but a vacation the week before the roadshow?
It's exactly the same vacation I've scheduled for next week. July 4th has always been a one-week vacation for me, yes.
So over what period were you on this particular vacation in 2000?
It was whatever the week was that included the 4th of July. So in that year, that was, I think, literally the first calendar week of July, plus or minus a day.
And when did the roadshow actually begin?
We flew to New York on either Sunday, I believe probably Sunday, the end of that week, and we began working intensely with the underwriters to pull all the final pieces together to begin the roadshow. I think our first roadshow presentation was Wednesday of that following week.
Do you recall the date?
I would guess it's around the 10th, maybe 10th, 11th.
And how long did the roadshow continue? When was the last presentation?
Last presentation was on July 28th.
The purpose of a roadshow, Mr. Flatley, is to solicit investment in the initial public offering. Is that right?
That's right.
Convince people to sell... Convince people to buy stock in connection with the IPO. Is that correct?
That's right.
Now, you used... Strike that. You were one of the presenters on the roadshow.
I was the primary presenter.
And you used PowerPoint slides as part of your presentation?
Yes.
Let's take a look, please, at Exhibit 269. We've seen this exhibit before also. This is an email from Mark Chi to yourself and other members of the Illumina Roadshow team dated July 13th, 2000, correct?
Yes.
You received this email at some point while you were still on the roadshow, right?
Well, this was actually routed to our entire senior staff at that time, so it wasn't just the roadshow team. And this probably came into my email box while I was on the roadshow. And the way my email is set up, I can view the first few lines of an email without downloading the whole thing, so It may be I didn't see all of this, and I either deleted it or forwarded it on.
The people that the email was addressed to, yourself, Dr. Barker, Dr. Stupnagel, and Tim Kish, the four of you were the roadshow team, is that right?
We were the Illumina representatives on the roadshow team. There was a large entourage of others.
In terms of who was there from Illumina, those are the four people from Illumina who are on the roadshow, right?
Yes.
You and Tim Kish made presentations, and Dr. Barker and Dr. Stupnagel were on the roadshow to answer questions. Is that correct?
To answer questions in addition to Tim and myself. So it wasn't we present the answer. It was, you know, additional. They could answer questions.
Now, you had asked Mark Chi to keep you informed of the status of the 768 decoding experiment while you were on the roadshow, didn't you?
I wouldn't characterize it that way. I asked Mark Chi to keep me informed of the status of all kinds of experiments we were doing.
Did you ask Mark Chi to keep you advised of the status of the 768 decode experiment while you were on the roadshow?
I may have. Mark sends me emails all the time about the status of our experiments, and I would have loved to keep up to date on this and other things in the company.
Mr. Flatley, at some point you learned about a problem with the mislabeling of a dye that was used in connection with the 768 decode experiment. Is that right?
I did, yes.
Do you agree, sir, that this mislabeled dye probably resulted in some invalid data from the 768 decode experiment?
Objection calls for speculation.
Sustained lack of personal knowledge.
He's the highest-ranking officer at Illumina. You talked with Mark Chi about this experiment from time to time, didn't you?
While I was on the roadshow?
No. Just from time to time, you've had discussions with Mark Chi about the 768 decode experiment, haven't you?
What do you mean by time to time?
Anytime.
If I did, they were very cursory.
The only discussions you've had with Mark Chi about the 768 decode experiment were discussions you describe as cursory? Is that right?
Let me be very clear here. We use the term the 768 experiment in this litigation. We had all sorts of experiments going on. We had other ones that were 768 experiments. We talked about all kinds of experiments. The 768 experiment happened to be the one that occurred during this time frame, and so I've talked to Mark about lots of experiments, this one and others. I never sat down with Mark and had a meeting about this experiment.
Pretty picture. Let's talk about this 768 decode experiment, the one reflected in the PowerPoint slide that Mark Chi sent to the roadshow team with Illumina bait stamp 1560. Did you ever talk to Mark Chi about that experiment?
Maybe. I don't have a specific recollection of talking to him about it. I read this email when I got back. I don't know if we had a conversation directly about this at all.
Did you have a conversation with David Barker, the chief scientific officer, about this experiment?
It's very difficult to distinguish any conversation about this experiment versus lots of others that were going on. We did have, when I got back, some quick conversations about the fact that there had been mislabeled dye, and we were going to try to recover the funds for the dye. But I just don't recall specifically having any particular discussion about this experiment.
Let me try to refresh your recollection. I'm going to read from your deposition testimony, beginning at page 483, line 20. This is dealing with a discussion with David Barker.
Hold on, counsel. Just a moment. Okay.
Page 43, line 20. Did Dr. Barker express the view that any of the data that was obtained from that experiment might be compromised as a result of the mislabeled reagent?
Again, I think that's a mischaracterization of any conversation I had with David about it. I mean, if a reagent was mislabeled, that part of the experiment, we needed to fix that problem and repeat it.
Skipping down to 84, line 10. Did Dr. Barker express the view that results obtained from using the mislabeled reagent might be compromised?
We never used the word might be compromised.
Without using the words, did he ever express that view to you?
The view we had was, if a component is mislabeled, then the data from that label doesn't work, and so you fix it and move on.
What do you mean the data from the label doesn't work?
That if you think you have one dye on some material, and what you really have is another dye, that part of the experiment where you are reading that dye is invalid data, so you fix the problem and do it again.
So did you direct Dr. Barker to fix the problem and do it again?
I had no need to direct David Barker to do that.
Is that what Dr. Barker told you he was going to do?
Not in so many words.
So you just assumed that Dr. Barker, being a competent scientist, would do that?
Dr. Barker didn't even need to direct anybody to do that. We had very competent scientists at all levels of the organization, and it was obvious to everybody that we needed to fix the problem and repeat the experiment.
Was it obvious to you, sir, you needed to fix this problem with the mislabeled reagent and redo the experiment?
Of course.
Did you do that? Did you redo the 768 decoding experiment after the roadshow?
I don't know if we precisely designed the next experiment to mimic this precise one. We probably, since we'd had such good results and decoded 500 to 600 bead types, we probably took the next step and changed several variables. So we didn't need to do this exact experiment again. We've moved on to the next series.
You and Dr. Barker talked about fixing the problem and repeating the experiment, correct?
Well, you are reading literally there. By repeating the experiment, we do the next experiment. And so the next experiment could have been maybe we chose 1,000, maybe we said that was pretty good, so let's move to 1,000. I don't know what the next exact one was they did. But in any case, what we would want to do, obviously, is to take a bad dye, take it out of the system, and put good dye in, and do whatever the next experiment was. And that's what we were talking about.
During the roadshow presentations, the actual presentations, isn't it true that you made a representation to investors that you expected that Illumina's first product would have over 2,000 different bead types?
No, it's not the way it was characterized.
Did you represent to investors that you expected your product to be able to decode something in the range of 2,000 different bead types?
Yeah, our target was to be in the neighborhood of 2,000. We told people we would be up to 2,000 in the initial product launch.
You made representations to investors that your first product, that you expected it to range of about 2,000 beads, right?
The number of beads we put in a product depends what the product is. So it could be anywhere up to 2,000, but somewhere in that range is what our target was.
I'm asking you specifically what you represented to investors on the roadshow. Did you represent to investors that you expected the first product to contain in the range of about 2,000 beads?
So let me be very specific how we do the presentation. We didn't talk about Illumina products in the roadshow specifically. We talked about a product that ABI was going to launch that used a piece of Illumina's technology. When we described the technology, we talked about these fiber bundles, talked about how many overall fibers we had, and on that fiber, we expected in the first product to have a certain level of redundancy, and we therefore have about 2,000 unique bead types in that range at about 25 times redundancy. How many we actually deploy would depend specifically on the type of product you want to launch, which was undefined at that time.
Let me read again from your deposition testimony on the subject of what representations you made on the roadshow. Page 462, line 4. What, if anything, did you say with respect to the number of bead types that you anticipated that Illumina might be able to decode in the future?
We expected that it would be in the range of 2,000 per fiber bundle.
And what scientific experiments were you relying on in making that representation?
We were relying on the fact we had demonstrated that the decoding process worked with a smaller set of beads.
And would the experiment you were relying on in making that representation have included a 768 decode experiment conducted under the direction of Kevin Gunderson?
Our representation to investors was that our arrays in our first product we expected to contain in the range of about 2,000 beads. And that fact that that was our product target included everything I knew about everything we had done.
Moving on to page 464, line 13. Was your belief that you would be able to at some point decode 2,000 different bead types, was that based at least in part on the experiments that Kevin Gunderson was running using 768 different bead types?
Wasn't directly coupled to that, but it was in part based on that experiment and every other one we had ever done.
Did you ever talk to Kevin Gunderson about whether he felt that any results from the 768 decode experiment were compromised or faulty?
I don't believe I ever had a direct conversation with Kevin about the experiment.
Was that the date of the initial, when Illumina went public?
July 28th, 2000.
Take a look, please, at Exhibit 287, Mr. Flatley. Is this an email you sent to the entire company on August 2nd of 2000?
Yes.
This is after the IPO and when you returned back to Illumina?
Correct.
So how much money was raised in the Illumina initial public offering?
Well, if you include what's called the green shoe here, which is a second piece of the offering that's optional, and you subtract expenses, the total was about $103 million net.
$103 million net?
Net of expenses, about half of which we've burned through to date.
What was the original strike price for the IPO?
What's your definition of strike price?
What was the initial price at which persons could invest in the IPO?
The question is ambiguous, because it depends a little bit on who you are talking about, and the public, or people that were buying in, friend of the family. Those prices are different.
What was the opening price the day that Illumina went public on the stock market?
The final offering price was $16 a share, meaning the investors on the roadshow paid $16 a share to get the stock. The first public trade that was done was at a somewhat higher price than that. I don't recall what the exact price was.
When did you begin discussions of what the offering price would be? Over what period were those discussions?
Probably began in July 2000. Probably start to get a little bit of specificity around the February 2000 timeframe. We had to select underwriters first, and as part of that discussion with underwriters, you talk about what the potential value of the company might be.
Let me back up in time a little bit. You claimed a couple of times in the course of your testimony that Dr. Zarnik at some point resigned his employment with Illumina.
Definitely. Absolutely.
When is it you claim Dr. Zarnik resigned?
It was late in March, around 22nd or 23rd of March.
You are saying this wasn't an offer to give up a job title or change duties. This was a flat-out resignation?
No question about that.
I quit.
Yep.
You did understand, sir, that if Dr. Zarnik was simply resigning, that he was walking away from hundreds of thousands of shares of stock.
Sure. He could join another startup and get another few hundred thousand shares of stock at another startup. That's not something he was giving up permanently. He would give up Illumina's and get the new one.
Did you inform Deborah Flamino of Dr. Zarnik's alleged resignation?
I informed John Stupnagel. I'm not positive I informed Deborah about that. In retrospect, I should have. If I didn't, I guess I had an excess of discretion there, perhaps.
Let me read from your deposition testimony on this point.
Sure.
Beginning at page 431, line 8. We were looking at a particular exhibit dated April 17th when I asked this question. Well, let's say as of April 17th, 2000, which is the date of Exhibit 47, as of that date, just give me the list of names of persons you had already informed of Dr. Zarnik's purported resignation.
I'd informed John Stupnagel, Mark Chi, David Barker, I believe Deborah Flamino. At that point, that was probably everyone.
Why did you inform Deborah Flamino that Tony Zarnik had purportedly resigned?
Because Deborah Flamino was our HR supervisor.
Did you expect her to take some action in response to you informing her that Dr. Zarnik had resigned?
She would need to be poised to have a reaction to process an employee leaving the company, and so I alerted her, as I would with anyone resigning from the company, that we had a person departing. And when that happens, there's exit interviews, there's paperwork to process, and Deb needed to be knowledgeable about that possibility.
All right. So you told her to get ready to do that, is that right?
I did not say that to her, no.
Well, did you tell her to take any particular action?
No.
This was for her information only, is that right?
I did not need to tell Deb what to do when an employee resigns. She knew what to do.
What was Deborah Flamino's reaction when you told her that Dr. Zarnik had resigned?
She was surprised.
Do you recall what Ms. Flamino said, if anything, in expressing her surprise when you allegedly told her about the resignation?
No, I don't. I mean, as I testified, I don't recall directly telling Deb about this. I thought I had told her about it. It could be what I did tell Deb. We were in severance discussions with Tony, and I may not have used the word resign with her. I'm not sure.
Your testimony was that you told her because she needed to get ready for the resignation, prepare paperwork, get ready for exit interviews. Is that why you talked to her?
That's why I would have talked to her, sure.
Did you actually do anything, sir, to process or act upon this so-called resignation?
Yes.
What did you do?
When Tony came in and resigned, I asked him what were the specifics surrounding his resignation in terms of his transition plan. Did he have a transition plan for the projects, a time frame? He said he didn't, that the situation was intolerable for him and he needed to leave. So I asked him to go away to think about that overnight and come back the next day and give me the specifics surrounding his departure. And when he did that is when we first heard that he wanted to leave instantly and take all his stock with him. So we entered into a discussion and a debate back and forth about what an appropriate package might be for Tony as a result of that resignation.
Did you process any paperwork in connection with the purported resignation?
There was no paperwork to process. We never got to that point. We were in severance negotiations, as we've discussed, that reached an impasse.
Let's take a look at Exhibit 168, please. You are familiar with this form, the change of status form at Illumina?
Yes.
And is that your signature on the change of status form?
Yes.
And in this form, you were transferring Dr. Zarnik from CSO to the position of research fellow?
That's correct.
That's right?
Uh-huh.
Is this the only paperwork that was submitted with respect to Dr. Zarnik's employment status in the spring of 2000, to your knowledge?
Can you read back the question, please?
Is this the only paperwork that was submitted with respect to Dr. Zarnik's employment status in the spring of 2000 in terms of human resources paperwork?
In terms of compensation changes, yes. There were warning memos and things we talked about that you could say had to do with his employment status, but this and the agreement that we had drafted are the documents that related to the change of his compensation.
There never was any change of status form to reflect a resignation, was there?
You would never have one until you reached an agreement on a resignation, on a status of how you were going to do it.
You claim at some point Dr. Zarnik withdrew his resignation?
In effect, yes. We reached an impasse on the negotiations, as I've testified, and Dr. Zarnik in an email said he wanted to continue to work with Illumina because we had not reached an agreement. He wanted to take all the stock. I was unwilling to let him do that, so he wrote an email that said, basically, he wanted to continue working.
Could we take a quick look at one more exhibit? I know we're at the lunch break, but it's the same subject. Exhibit 334. We'll come back to this after lunch, Mr. Flatley, but this is the termination memo that you gave Dr. Zarnik, is that right?
That's right.
Dated September 5th of 2000, is that right?
That's right.
And by the way, did your attorney, Miss Kearns, draft this letter?
Miss Kearns probably helped me draft this letter.
And we'll get back to other portions of this letter later, but I want to ask you about this sentence. You stated your intention to resign from Illumina earlier this year and subsequently changed your mind and withdrew your resignation. When do you claim Dr. Zarnik changed his mind and withdrew his resignation? What approximate date?
I had to go back and look at the email trail there, but it was basically at that time we reached an impasse around the negotiation. We were about to start the roadshow. Tony said my offer is off the table, basically the day before the roadshow started. I hope this doesn't hurt your IPO, doesn't damage the IPO, and I want to continue to work, and so it was roughly in that time frame.
Your Honor, this would be an appropriate time.
We'll take our noon recess at this time. We'll be in recess until 1 o'clock. Please remember the admonition not to form or express opinions about the case, not to discuss the case. We'll be in recess until 1 p.m. 1 p.m. You have about 20 minutes left?
I'm not going to make it in 20 minutes, but it's pretty close.
We have to finish this today.
I can't hear you.
We have to finish this today.
I know, so I'm concerned about Mr. Pantone going over. We worked very hard to map out these time schedules.
In good conscience, the first examination under the new schedule, Miss Kearns ran about 15 minutes over, very first one. Other than that, we've been on track. I may run a few minutes over, but not materially.
Okay, you have 20 minutes left. You agree with that, if we stick to the schedule?
come up a little shorter than that, but it's real close.
Okay.
I had 25 minutes.
Okay, try to finish at least within a half hour.
Okay.
The record will indicate all the jurors are present. Counsel are present. You may continue your examination, Mr. Pantone.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Flatley, I'm going to follow up on your testimony that when you showed the slide at the H&Q presentation in January of 2000, showing only John Stupnagel and Mark Chi as founders, your testimony was that that was just an error or an oversight. Do you recall giving a public presentation at a conference called the Healthwinds Tailwinds Conference of 2001?
Healthwinds Tailwinds? I think that's called the Tailwinds Conference.
What was the Tailwinds Conference?
A financial conference put on by an investment banking firm.
You made a presentation there regarding Illumina?
I did.
Let me show you what we've marked Exhibit 4, which is a transcript from your talk that day. We have an audio transcription of it, but I believe your counsel will stipulate this is an accurate transcription.
Yes, and this is, as indicated, it's an excerpt. It's not the entire text.
Right. So your counsel stipulated this is accurate. And at the Tailwinds 2001 conference, by the way, when was that held?
I'd be guessing, other than to say it was 2001.
In this talk, you indicated that the founders of the company were Dr. John Stupnagel from CW Group and Dr. Mark Chi, who came from Affymetrix. Is that right?
That's right.
Let's take a look at Exhibit 356. Do you recognize this, Mr. Flatley?
Only because I saw it this morning.
Did you give an interview to a publication called the Wall Street Transcript?
I think I've done that on a couple of occasions, yes.
Where you talk about Illumina?
Yes.
And did you indicate that John Stupnagel and Mark Chi founded Illumina?
Yes, on both these occasions. This is after Dr. Zarnik had left the company and certainly was under no obligation to add Dr. Zarnik to this list after he left the company.
Now, Mr. Flatley, with respect to the termination of Dr. Zarnik's employment, first of all, was it you, sir, who made the decision to terminate Dr. Zarnik's employment?
Yes, it was.
And Dr. Zarnik was reporting directly to you at that time, right?
That's correct.
So is it fair to say you were the only person who would have been authorized to make a decision to fire Tony Zarnik in 2000?
I think that's fair to say, yes.
When did you first consider terminating Tony Zarnik's employment?
I'd say...
Objection. I think this was asked and answered this morning.
This morning I asked when he first considered replacing him as chief science officer.
I'm sorry.
When did you first consider terminating Tony Zarnik's employment?
I'd say I decided on August 29th, 2000. With regard to the word consider, it's challenging to figure out exactly when I first started considering it, but I decided on August 29th.
August 29th, 2000, correct?
That's correct.
Let me show you what has been marked as Exhibit 333. I also have a blow-up of this. Exhibit 333 are notes that you made, Mr. Flatley, correct?
Yes.
All this writing on the document is yours, correct?
Yes, it is.
Is it true, sir, these notes reflect a conversation that you had with your attorney, Jennifer Kearns?
They reflect the comments that my attorney made to me in a phone conversation.
And the purpose of this phone conversation was for you and Miss Kearns to discuss what you would say to Dr. Zarnik when you fired him. Is that right?
It was intended to be talking points for a termination discussion.
Points that she was suggesting that you say to Dr. Zarnik when you fire him.
What I refer to as talking points for such a conversation.
Let me read your deposition testimony on this for clarity. At page 512, beginning at line 18... When did you prepare the notes in anticipation of the termination meeting?
The notes were generated based on a conversation I had with counsel, where our counsel walked through the sequence of things that I should discuss during the termination meeting.
That's the purpose of those notes, right?
Yes.
Now, you actually met with Dr. Zarnik on September 5th of 2000 for the purpose of terminating his employment. Is that right?
That's right.
Did any opinions that Dr. Zarnik expressed with regard to decoding enter into your decision to terminate his employment?
No.
Could you read the first line of your note, please, Exhibit 333, in terms of the notes that you and Miss Kearns discussed as to what you should say to Dr. Zarnik?
I understand you have expressed some strong opinions in the last few days about the state of decoding.
Did you, in fact, understand that Dr. Zarnik had expressed some strong opinions in the last few days about the state of decoding?
I got an email from Dr. Zarnik just before the termination meeting, where he expressed to me his concern about data that we had gathered and disseminated publicly.
So these notes, in terms of what Miss Kern suggested you actually say to Dr. Zarnik when you fired him, did you make the first point? Did you make that statement that's on the first line?
I didn't, no.
You did or did not?
I did not.
What about the second point? I want to remind you of your continuing obligation to hold all information about our technology confidential. If you do not, the company will pursue all its remedies. Did you make that statement?
I did. And it was a set. It included the first point, so I really made the second point only.
You made the second point on these notes. You actually said that.
Not verbatim.
Something to that effect?
Yes.
The notes go on to say, as I stated, we will intend to honor the severance terms of your employment agreement. However, I am prepared to offer you a comparable settlement offer of 3 months' salary and 20,000 shares. Did you say that to Dr. Zarnik?
I think it says compromise settlement.
I'm sorry, I misread it. So would you read your words?
As I stated, we'll intend to honor the severance terms of your employment agreement. However, I'm prepared to offer you a compromise settlement offer of 3 months' salary and 20,000 shares.
Did you make those statements to Dr. Zarnik at the termination meeting?
Again, not literally.
But you made a statement to that effect.
Made that offer to Dr. Zarnik, yes.
And the bottom portion of your notes, you've indicated three choices. 1, 2, 3.
That's correct.
What do those choices refer to?
Those are the choices as to how he might select to exit the company. We gave him three different options there.
Did you make statements to that effect to Dr. Zarnik?
Again, not literally, but yes.
Statements to that effect?
Yes.
So, if I understand you correctly, you say you made statements to the effect of every single thing on these notes except for the first line. Is that true?
That's true.
And decoding had nothing to do with the termination.
Decoding was irrelevant to me and irrelevant to the termination.
When you met with Dr. Zarnik for the purpose of terminating his employment, you told him that you were terminating his employment because he failed to meet his goals. Is that correct?
In large measure, it was failure to meet the goals, and of course the fact he made no effort to meet the goals.
The reason you gave him was failure to meet goals?
Which includes making an effort to meet them, yes.
You didn't say that, did you?
I don't recall what I said specifically.
Let me read your deposition testimony, see if this refreshes your recollection. On page 510, beginning at line 8, what reason, if any, did you give to Dr. Zarnik in the termination meeting for terminating his employment?
Because he had had specific objectives that I had given him that were intended to demonstrate his ability to provide capable, competent contributions to the company. And he had failed to meet those objectives.
And those specific objectives are the written goals you gave him on May 19th, 2000, is that right?
That's right.
Did you give any other reasons for the termination to Dr. Zarnik when you met with him?
No.
So it's true, sir. You told him he was fired for failing to meet his goals, correct?
I'm not sure exactly what I told him verbally. We did have a memo that went along with this that stated that failure to meet the goals, which was all-inclusive of goals and working on the goals, was the reason he was being terminated.
You're not contradicting your deposition testimony I just read, are you?
I don't think it's contradicting in any way, no.
I read what you said, and you told me what you said, correct?
Repeat that again.
I asked you at your deposition what you said to Dr. Zarnik, and you told me, to the best of your recollection, what you actually said.
I told you in concept what I said. I was never intending that to be reflective of my precise words to him.
You gave me all the reasons for the termination, correct?
There's more deposition testimony on reasons.
Let me read the deposition testimony again. Page 510, line 19. After what I just said, I asked you, did you give any other reasons for the termination of Dr. Zarnik when you met with him?
No.
Then on page 511...
Counsel, I think you mean to put it in context. You need to continue reading a follow-up question. Did you have any other reasons for terminating Dr. Zarnik's employment?
I asked specifically what reasons you communicated to Dr. Zarnik. The reasons you communicated were failure to meet goals, true?
Are you asking me what was my deposition, what was in the memo, or what did I say in the meeting? Can you clarify that for me?
When you met with Dr. Zarnik on September 5th, you told him he was fired for failure to meet goals.
I handed up a memo and had him read the memo. The memo said that.
Have you reviewed Deborah Flamino's deposition testimony about this same conversation?
No, I have not.
Deborah Flamino was present during this conversation, was she not?
She was.
At some point, sir, did you also decide to terminate the employment of Rich Pytalewski?
Yes, I did.
When did you make the decision to terminate Rich Pytalewski's employment?
I believe it was in the February timeframe of 2000. I don't recall that exactly.
And when did you communicate that to Rich Pytalewski, your decision to terminate his employment?
We reached a mutual agreement in about that time frame.
And when did Rich Pytalewski actually leave the employment of Illumina?
It was May 2000, I believe.
And again, sir, you were the person who made the decision to terminate Rich Pytalewski's employment.
Yes, I am.
How many shares of stock of Illumina do you own, Mr. Flatley?
Approximately 970,000.
970,000? Is that what you said?
That's what I said.
When do you become fully invested in those shares?
In all of them, probably 7 years from now.
What about the shares you got when you initially joined the company? When do you become vested in those shares?
It's indeterminate because some of them are performance-based. Depending how the company performs, could be 10 years from now.
How many shares are you vested in right now?
I believe it's about half of those.
So, roughly 500,000 shares?
No, it's less than that. I think it's about 450,000.
Do you have any plans to leave Illumina before you become fully vested?
No.
I'll save whatever time I have left, Judge.
Which is none. We'll give you a little additional time.